reasons why they couldn't take on the responsibility. The fact that they had become president and secretary a week after they'd become Christians, that earlier generation, seemed to have been forgotten. Women were also seen as more intuitive in their makeup and general temperament, and not able to think through what the executive committee wanted, which was a definite logical policy. So the arguments went on for some time. Contrary arguments were, of course, put. From the biblical point of view, when men and women had equal partnership, texts were quoted back and forth. And it's interesting that one person in this period said, we need to have a witness within KICU against the background of the general and deplorable attitude towards women in the university. And this was the argument that prevailed, that this was actually a Christian witness that needed to be made. The perspectives of women in KICU contributed to the spiritual impetus which was behind the 70. The Women's Committee of KICU noted in 1954 that in Homerton College, several women had come to know Christ during the first weeks of term. And what happened from that time on within Homerton was the emergence of fellowship meetings, as they were called. And the executive committee discussing this saw the value of what was happening in Homerton, the value of this fellowship. And the background might well have been the way in which the East African Revival, with its fellowship meetings and its missionary Joe Church, who was a missionary of KICU, that influence was coming back into Britain from East Africa. The emphasis on openness, walking in the light with other Christians, and particularly the book, The Calvary Road, which had a huge impact on the evangelical community at the time. So these fellowship meetings were beginning to burgeon, not only then within Homerton, but spreading to other colleges within the university. So the environment, I think, was one of a deepening spirituality, and I think that's very important when we think about what happened with the Cambridge 70, and the fact that it came from one of the women's colleges, I would say, is significant. Now, KICU was not a local church, although arguably for many evangelical students, it had a place in their lives that was as central, perhaps more central, than local church life. However, churches also had an influence on the formation of members of the 70. In some cases, this began before university, the influence of the local churches. Valerie, later Valerie Jones, a Homerton student who went to East Africa, had a school friend, she says, who persuaded me to go to a sixth form Christian college to talk to her vicar, who suggested confirmation classes. He presented Bible truths, she said, clearly, and I made a commitment to Christ towards the end of the classes. At the final interview with the vicar, he asked me if I knew what I'd be doing on leaving school. Valerie said no, and he mentioned the possibility of missionary work. At that stage, Valerie, a new Christian, knew nothing about missionaries, and so she looked up the subject in a careers book. This said that nursing experience was useful. This didn't appeal to her. However, as she investigated further, she found teaching the deaf in the careers book, which led her to teacher training and led her to Homerton. In her period in Cambridge, overseas mission came on the agenda. She was impressed by missionaries she heard, inspirational figures, such as Gladys Aylward here. She heard Joe Church, and we've come on to Billy Graham. She joined a Rwanda prayer group in the university, met those associated with East Africa, including Robin Church, who was at Emmanuel College, the son of Joe Church, who became one of the 70, went as a doctor to Uganda. In Valerie's experience, one Sunday at St. Matthew's Church in Cambridge, where she was teaching in the Sunday school, Lawrence Barham from Rwanda was the speaker, and he turned to the Homerton students who were there and said, "Perhaps I will see some of you in Rwanda one day." And in Valerie's case, this is exactly what happened. So local churches and individuals and inspirational individuals were involved in her Christian commitment, and that's quite typical of a number. Through his impact in Cambridge in 1954, and especially as the leading missioner at the 1955 KICU mission, Billy Graham played a role in giving the vision of the 70 a considerable stimulus. In 1954, KQ members at Newnham took several friends to hear Billy Graham in Great St Mary's Church after Easter, and he had just finished his massive London campaign at that time. And it was reported that 10 of the women had stayed behind after the sermon, and 4 were continuing to have special Bible studies in Newnham. Great St Mary's was the main venue for the 1955 mission. Mervyn Stockwood was the vicar then. And Billy Graham was full of anticipation while confessing to his KQ co-workers that he had probably never undertaken a task for which, he said, I feel so inadequate and unqualified. Brian MacDonald Milne, who often comes to these seminars, he was not a member of KQ or of the 70, but he remembers that Billy Graham came to speak to students at the Divinity Faculty and spoke humbly and graciously, putting his own form of evangelism about fourth in a listing of 6 forms of evangelism. Now, I think it's significant that there was overlap between the students who were deeply involved in the Billy Graham mission and those who became part of the 70. So in that sense, there's no real dichotomy between whether it's mission now, here, or somewhere else. For example, Susan Reed, a student at Girton and then at Hughes Hall, who was the treasurer of the Billy Graham mission, was also part of the 70 and married Dick Williams, a fellow member of the 70. Colin Day, a college representative for KQ in King's College, invited a fellow student at King's, Tam Dyell, who became an MP and later father of the House of Commons. He invited Tam to one of the meetings. And although Tam was interested, he also shouted out at one point in Graham's message, "Surely not, Billy!" So he was obviously getting ready to be an MP at this point. He was sufficiently interested to agree to meet Graham, but in the end that didn't prove possible. Among the varied experiences during the mission week, one of the most significant for Richard Bewes was the opportunity he had to speak to Billy Graham about the 70. And he handed Billy Graham one of the many prayer cards that had been printed, and Billy Graham immediately took this up in conversation. At the final meeting of the mission, Graham spoke to KQ members, and there were those who felt the call to overseas mission at that last meeting. One was Basil Scott, who was reading history at Queen's College, became KQ president in 1957, and his memory of this is vivid. "I still," he says, "possess a small scrap of paper which records that Billy spoke on sacrifice and that the sacrifice of service was his final point. It was then I began to ask myself whether there was any sacrifice I should make. It was as though God had touched me in the hidden depths of my being. I must go. Of that, I have never since had a shadow of doubt." He continued, "The Lord's yes was so powerful that it has resounded in my heart ever since. That one word has controlled my life. It was God who had spoken." Ruth Anderson, as she became at Homerton, who was specialising in music and French and was a member of KQ and the Baptist Robert Hall Society, she too was deeply affected by Billy Graham's call to Christians to commit to service. Another student from Homerton had a similar experience. Says, "I can still remember Graham's challenge to the KQ members at the end of the mission. This was pivotal in my discipleship. He challenged us to live our whole lives for God wherever he led us." Those who felt the call to overseas mission usually went on after Cambridge to undertake further training. Jill Story, who had been at Newnham, went to a Wycliffe language course for help with language learning. Like others, she was drawn to the expanding work at that time of the Wycliffe Bible translators. She went for a year to London Bible College, LBC, which had started in the previous decade and had become the leading interdenominational evangelical Bible college in England. It was open to women and men on an equal footing. Jill Story was a year there studying Greek and Hebrew and other subjects before she went to Alaska. In the case of the women members of the 70 who became teachers overseas, teacher training was an important part of their preparation. Ruth Howard made a commitment to Christ during an earlier mission with John Stott, and he really became a KQ mentor. And as a member of the KQ prayer group for Kenya, Ruth's sense of call grew gradually, and after 4 years of teaching in Britain, she went to Nigeria. Similarly, Ruth Anderson, she was head of music in a secondary school in Cambridge before going overseas. Or another example, Mary Bogg became a head teacher in England until in the 1970s she and her husband, Mike Cawthorne, went to Pakistan. Those going into, so those are the teaching tracks. Those going into medical mission undertook further clinical work after Cambridge, and for some of them this could be a time of discerning future direction. John Maitland, whose wife Hilary had studied in Oxford, was also a doctor, had in mind going overseas with the China Inland Mission, but they met three CMS missionaries and as a result made contact with CMS. And they received an excited letter from the secretary of CMS recruitment saying that she'd been praying for someone to go, and here she had got two doctors instead of one. Other places in which people trained before they went, as well as London Bible College, the Bible Training Institute in Glasgow, the BTI, was an important place for further training. Keith Ranger is here with us after studying history at Downing College in Cambridge and became part of the 70, studied at the BTI for 2 years and found this a relevant and helpful preparation for overseas work as he went to Malaysia. And his work was focused on evangelism and Bible teaching. He married a fellow missionary, Catherine. And perhaps when we think about the role of women, we also need to think about the way in which couples worked together, because that was quite a common feature. Shirley, as I've mentioned, went to India 3 years in a college in Madras University in South India, and she and Basil worked together as a couple in student work. So here we have just a few of the people that I've mentioned. And for them, and I'll come back to this in a moment, there was something of enormous privilege to be in India and to be part of the nation's post-Raj history. John and Jean Wheatley Price, who served in East Africa, met when they were both training with CMS. And John and Jean are here. Jean had come to Christian commitment when a student nurse in Oxford. So we've got the dynamic here of couples working together. For other women members of the 70, their ministry overseas was as single women. This was the case for Margaret Gilbert, who's here. She assumed, first of all, her call was to Africa, but then later the call came to India to teach near Mumbai. And to a large extent, for her as for others, her family was those with whom she worked. In her case, the Bible and Medical Missionary Fellowship, later InterServe. Other women found that their call to overseas mission didn't work out in the way they expected. Pat Moss was expecting that she would go overseas after teaching in this country, but she applied to CIM, OMF, and refused because she was refused because she got hay fever, it's a thought. Pat ended up teaching at a Christian boarding school in England, Clarendon School, for 31 years. And through this, she made an important contribution to world mission, as many of the parents of the children were missionaries. And through contact with parents, she was able to make visits to Uganda and India to teach maths. Now, I'm not able to cover all that was done by the women of the 70 overseas. I hope you've got a feeling of the things that motivated them to go. There were definitely trends, if you look at the experiences overseas. This was a time of partnership with the churches overseas. Ruth Howard spoke about the emphasis on partnership in world mission, people prayerfully discovering together, not the missionaries imposing something. And she spoke about the way in which CMS had adapted in many ways over the years that she was involved. She said it's hardly now the same organization looking back, but she said this is to be expected as the Spirit leads. And for her, the new global approach was truly inspiring and exhilarating. Ruth remained in Nigeria in significant teaching posts for 20 years, had a break, and then went back for a further 13 years. So you have these very long term as part of the story. And she spoke about how her journey took her from a very paternalistic background in her family to a very different outlook to towards Nigerian colleagues. So partnership is definitely a trend. Another trend is adaptations linked with this to the post-colonial context. Mission practice in many countries in the 1960s was deeply affected by this. John and Hilary Maitland arrived in Uganda to start their work in 1962, 2 months after Uganda became independent. And my dear friend Peter Conlon has actually managed to add a Ugandan flag to a picture which didn't originally have the Ugandan flag. But it's absolutely right. They had independence had come, there was tension, but this also opened up new opportunities, this post-colonial experience, and they were able to become involved alongside local people in training, more and more local professionals to take over work in a hospital. They formed a development trust which supported schools and water holes, boring water, and encouraging small businesses. Again, Basil and Shirley going to India in the post-colonial context and speaking about how important it was not to live on mission compounds, but in housing that was alongside the people, not distanced from them. A third trend, an awareness of what could be learned as well as what could be contributed. In Burundi and in Kenya, Valerie Jones came to value what she learned of fellowship from people who, she said, spoke easily of the Lord. This is what she learned from the African Christians. They wanted to know, how are you with the Lord? She also enjoyed the simple lifestyle as she became aware that in the UK we had more than enough. And when people asked Valerie if she had encountered culture shock going to Burundi, she replied, and this was a common response, that the culture shock was on returning to the UK. At both the witness seminars that Emma has already mentioned, there was appreciation of the churches overseas. John spoke of their willingness to sacrifice, their joyfulness in God, their desire to share the gospel, their great love for God's word. And so amongst all of those, if you get the chance to speak to members of the 70 who are here today, you'll find exactly the same story. The enjoyment, as Keith put it, of working under indigenous leadership wherever possible. Another feature is openness to changes of direction that I've observed in looking at this. So Juliet Israel went to Nigeria initially on a 2-year contract and didn't expect to stay long term in Africa, but that's exactly what happened. She actually met her future husband on the boat to Nigeria. And after they got married, they worked in Uganda, where Anthony was a chaplain and a head of department. In somewhat similar vein, Valerie, who I mentioned before from Hobarton, went to Burundi as a short-termer to teach for 4 years, but this changed as a result of meeting and marrying Ken Jones, whom she had previously known, and they taught together in Kenya. Again, for the Rangers, ministry in Malaysia led on to ministry in Hong Kong and to other countries. And I've discerned a certain movement during the period amongst those who went overseas. It isn't a fixed situation. Sometimes the political situation meant that new directions had to be taken. This was also a period when short-term mission was beginning to come onto the agenda, although through new missionary societies such as Operation Mobilization, which I've, OM, probably better known, which I've done work on, well, written a book on its history. But some examples here, I put up Catherine Porter here, who I know because she's a later student from Cambridge who went out with Operation Mobilization. But for most of the 70, this was not something that they had in mind, this idea of short-term mission. Some, certainly Sheila Rumble, didn't have long-term plans. She was at Girton, reading modern languages. Her faith came alive through KICU. She went to London Bible College and then to Barcelona. But for her, there were only, in her mind, a number of years that she was going to be there. However, the advantage in the view of the Cambridge 70 of long-term mission was deep involvement in culture. So the drawback of the short term was that deep involvement and immersion in culture didn't happen. Jill Story served with Wycliffe from 1958 to 2010, she was able to immerse herself meant that she was able to offer, as a Wycliffe person, a wide range of consultancy to many organisations that were interested in cross-cultural work, not necessarily only Christian organisations. The Scots who are here worked in India for 25 years with trips back at rare intervals to begin with, and more frequently as mission service patterns changed. And one of the things with Basil and Shirley and others is coming back because of family reasons. At the time when children are thinking about university and the way in which families are important. The last member of the 70 to go overseas was Jan King, who's spoken at one of these seminars, previously Jan Murray Scott. She was converted through KIKU in 1953 when she was at Girton College. Soon afterwards at the Keswick Convention, and that's another story that, of the mission associations with the Keswick Convention in this period, she felt the call to mission work in another country. This was not realised, however, until 1995, when after a long career in teaching, she went to Sudan with the Africa Inland Mission and was seconded to the Sudan Literature Centre, which was part of ACROSS, the Association of Christian Resource Agencies Serving Sudan. And I've got somewhere, I think, Jan's book that she's recently written, if you want to have a look at it. Many members of the 70, this is the last section now, returned to Britain to carry on local church or wider ministries. And in the book, I've spent more time on this. Obviously, all that's written here is an expansion of the short paper. When John and Jean Wheatley Price returned to the UK, they found the Church of England, and England generally, in the 1970s, a place and a body that regarded service overseas as largely irrelevant and inferior. Also, by comparison with Africa, they found the clergy and people in leadership in England, people who didn't see that they were in a missionary situation. Many were tired, dispirited, had lost their vision, and had little message for the situation which confronted them. And the Wheatley Prices, the Scots, and the Rangers, who I've worked most closely with in this project, along with Colin Day, all of them speak about coming back and realising that their cross-cultural experience was now of great value in a country, this country, that had changed so radically. So we have a very different kind of England to one that existed in the 1950s. And here we have multicultural, cross-cultural experience being put into effect in mission work in this country. And Shirley and others have spoken about mission in the words of Michael Nasir Ali, from everywhere to everywhere. So to conclude, the period in which the 70 heard the call to world mission was a time in Cambridge University of buoyancy, the challenge that was brought to the Christian Union in that period, a challenge which was heard by well over 70 in the end, well over 80 who went overseas, and particularly heard by women in the disproportionate number of women who became part of the 70 when compared to the university as a whole and KIKU as a whole. With the influence of Billy Graham in this period, it was a time when what has been called the post-World War II evangelical renaissance was taking place. A lot of church life quickened. There's many things that have been said about that. And by the end of the 50s, people beginning to talk about the amazing numbers of people offering for Christian service overseas and in this country. This study then of the Cambridge 70 adds to that picture, because this hasn't been written up before, but it is part of a wider picture of the period. For the Cambridge students who became part of the 70, the sense of being caught up in God's purposes remained with them through the decades. And for the last of the 70 to go overseas, Jan King, it was a wonderful experience to be able to spend 17 years after she'd retired, using her skills in education to assist women as well as men who had nothing of the educational advantages which were present in Britain. Oliver Bartley, who's written the history of PQ, comments that the 70, as they prepared to cross cultural boundaries, which of course applies now to any mission anywhere, they provide a challenge to self-sacrificing service, he said. And it's been my privilege to be part of their story. And I believe that in a very different global context to the one in which they first heard the call, the challenge that they heard